Andrew Locke certainly has a lofty claim to fame. He's the only Australian to climb all 14 of the world's 8,000-metre mountains. And although his days of climbing the highest peaks are now over, Andrew's new book, Summit 8000, relives all of his death-defying ascents while revealing exactly why he does it. Andrew sat down with Annie Hastwill, who began by asking him whether he's ever had an expedition that went smoothly.
No. I've had some wonderful ascents where everything has gone right, but the reality is I'm climbing at 8,000 metres, which is well inside what we call the death zone, where you simply cannot survive if you stay up there too long, even with auxiliary oxygen. So every expedition is an epic, and every expedition I lose 10 kilos and have some near-death experiences. But, you know, it's because the challenge, the outcome of the challenge is uncertain, that it is such an attractive challenge. I wouldn't want to do it if I knew it would be easy and that I would succeed.
How much has climbing changed in the time that you've been doing it?
Look, it really has. There's been an evolution in the commercialisation of the mountaineering. So when Ed Hillary and others climbed the peaks back in the 50s, they were generally national expeditions. One person getting to the summit was success for the whole expedition. Then private climbers like myself came along, and we're generally in small teams doing it in lightweight style. And what we've seen since the early 90s has been this evolution of commercial climbing, where inexperienced people can be considered paid to be guided up, and with lots of oxygen and Sherpa support can be assisted to get there. Commercial climbing has been around, guided climbing has been around since mountains have first been climbed. But unfortunately, the Himalayas is now being overwhelmed by the volume of commercial expeditioning, and that needs some regulation.
Does the crowded mountain take away from the purity of the experience, from your point of view?
Well, it does for me, absolutely. I don't enjoy, and I certainly seek to avoid, climbing routes that have been commercialised and overwhelmed by these large numbers of people, and all the supporting logistics of ropes and camps and all the rest, which take away from the challenge. But every mountain has a plethora of routes, different routes, so one can quite easily choose a more difficult route, and you won't find any guided climbs on the tougher climbs.
How many different reasons do people climb for? Now that we've got that many people wanting to get to the top of these amazing peaks, how many different motivations are there?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I think, look, the majority of commercial clients seem to want to tick the box, if you like, in the bucket list, and they can afford to do it, and for whatever motivation takes them there. For me, it's always been about the challenge to see if I can do it. And when I first set out to climb Everest, it was to see if I could. And when I had climbed Everest and a bunch of other peaks and set my sights on climbing all of the 8,000 metre peaks, then it was to see if I could. And at the time that I took on that challenge, only six or seven of the world's elite mountaineers had achieved it. So it was a worthwhile challenge, and again, where the outcome was uncertain, and that's what made it worthwhile for me.
Now, an avalanche this year took the lives of 16 local Sherpas and guides. How much has that single incident changed the politics of climbing, or how much will it change the politics of climbing, do you think?
I'm not sure if it's changed the politics of climbing, but it certainly highlighted the politics of commercial guided climbing in the Himalaya, in the Nepal Himalaya. And there has been, as part of that evolution of guided climbing, many of the roles that were traditionally carried out by the experienced foreign climbers have been taken on by the Sherpas, i.e. the locating and specifically the route finding and putting in place the safety ropes. Unfortunately, the responsibility that goes with that role hasn't necessarily been accepted by those people doing it. And so what you see now is a large number of quite inexperienced and unqualified Sherpa climbers working as guides for these paying clients. But the Sherpas themselves may not have had any training and may be very inexperienced and are being put at great risk. And I don't, whilst I'm not a great supporter of commercial expeditioning on the big mountains, I don't see it as being the fault of the paying clients, whether the market will be addressed. I see it as being the responsibility of the government of Nepal to regulate this burgeoning industry and the commercial operators who employ these Sherpas to to make sure that the people doing the job are qualified and well trained.
Is it a bit of a moment, you know, that something's become a boom and the rules haven't been looked at closely enough? Do you think that avalanche was that moment?
I certainly hope it is that moment. My greatest fear is that no lessons will be learnt from that terrible incident, and the commercial expeditioning will just go on, and the catch cry will be that, you know, it's the fault of the fat foreigners who are paying to be hauled up the mountain at the expense of the Sherpas. But really, the lessons are that when you're working on these highest mountains as guides, you need the very best training and qualifications, and the numbers need to be limited, and all of this should be achieved through appropriate government regulation.
Mountaineer Andrew Locke speaking with Annie Hastwell, and Andrew will tour his book Summit 8000, published by Victory Books, nationally from next month.